Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
And this week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Indra Bishnoi, who is a postdoc fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And we spoke about her research on disgust. So we spoke about like what disgust is. We spoke about a mouse model of disgust, which I thought was super interesting. How disgust is actually, and nausea is related to chemotherapy, and how it could be important to have a way to stop disgust in for chemotherapy so people continue to get the treatment. Yeah, so it was a really fun episode. And I'm also this week recording at The Space in Brunswick. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoy.
My name's Indra Bishnoi, and I've been born and raised in Canada. So between Montreal, Quebec, but also Brampton, Ontario, I spent a lot of my years. Then I moved to London, Ontario, just about 2 hours south of Toronto. And there I completed my undergrad and my PhD at Western University. So recently I moved to Boston and I started my postdoc here in Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And I'm looking at a lot of the effects of mutations in a high-risk gene associated with ASD or autism spectrum disorder. But outside of my work, I'm really an avid member of the environment and sustainability community. Love painting, recently been more and more into gaming. And I also like to spend a lot of time at the beach and exploring other areas of Boston. So
your PhD, well, a component of it was on disgust.
Yeah.
So we've all heard of the term disgust, but could you explain what the definition of it is in science and why we would want to study this?
Yeah. So I really like this question, and I want to start off with understanding your definition of disgust, if you don't mind. Sorry to push you on the spot.
No, that's great. My definition of disgust. Well, this is funny when I was reading your work, but it's just like a feeling. Like it just is like, This is wrong. This is like, and I have that thing. Yeah. What's the thing when you hate all those little holes?
Oh my gosh. I know what you're talking about. Oh my goodness. I know what you're talking about.
You know what because I was like, oh, maybe you know more about that. Because
that's hilarious.
Because that's the first thing that came to my head. It was just like a body feeling. You want to be sick, but I'm not sure like exactly how I would define it.
Okay, I can see that. I think what you're looking for is tryptophobia, right? Yes, like the ones with the holes. Yeah, exactly. I love that. I mean, phobias are a type of anxiety, and we're actually going to be back to anxieties later, I think. So that is very interesting that you mentioned that. So I like those definitions quite a bit. And I think you touch on really a number of interesting components of disgust, because I think disgust is so universally experienced. So I always have liked doing research in things that have a clear impact. I find that the research that I do has to have impacts within 2 to 3 steps, roughly, if you want to quantify it, although it's really hard to quantify that type of research, right? But I just like seeing the translatability. And I think disgust-related work is just such a clear example of that, because it is such a universal, basic, negative emotion or affect. So just to define a basic emotion for those of your listeners maybe who are less familiar with like the affective or emotional neuroscience side, it's basically just means when something is experienced universally, something that has shared facial expressions across different cultures, for example, something that's apparent from birth, and something that actually requires a lot less broad brain regions. So there are some specific brain regions that we can point to for certain emotions, although of course, like any function, there is typically a network that is involved. But that's generally how we define a basic emotion, and that is how disgust fits as a basic emotion as well. But I think when scientists are actually defining it for our research, as you know, we have to operationalize things, right? Like, how do we actually test it? How do we understand what disgust is? what is that functional definition, right? So when we're talking about core disgust or the main type of disgust, we think about it more so as a response that is designed to reduce the probability of harm. For example, by avoiding something or by getting rid of something. Like if you ingest a toxin, maybe you're more likely to vomit. Now, these responses can be very variable. So everything from locomotion, like moving away from a location so that avoidance, to facial expressions that we associate with disgust as it is a universal emotion. So things like lowered eyebrows, that wrinkling of the nose, those raised like upper lips and the lips protruding as well. We also see similarities with fear, with that increased heart rate, the sweating, skin conductance, of course. But I think one of those telltale signs, as you were mentioning as well, was that uneasiness you get in the stomach, right? So that nausea response as well, which can often be accompanied by vomiting as well. But again, it goes even further than this, right? Even in a broad sense, when we're looking at distancing ourselves, it might be something that harms us. It could be physical, it could be, you know, a pathogen, for example, but it can also be psychological or, you know, some type of harm to our moral well-being. So those are, I think, the many definitions of disgust that we work with in this area. And there's also so much more, but I think in a nutshell, that's really what we're talking about when we're thinking about disgust and trying to study it.
So why then do people feel disgusted by different things? Because it feels like that there's some things people can cope with, some people can't. Like, yeah, why is that?
So the reason I really like this question is because disgust is such a basic emotion, yet, and such a universal emotion, yet there is so much variability in what people feel disgusted by and also the level or the severity of that disgust. And I think anybody could recognize that. So a fun fact that I wanted to share here is that individuals who are more likely to display one form of disgust, like maybe to a pathogen, for example, are also more likely to display other forms of disgust, like moral disgust, for example. And I really like this example and this fact because it really speaks nicely to the dependencies that disgust has within our bodies and how much overlap there is in the mechanisms across the different types of disgust. Although I'll get into this distinctions as well, but for your listeners who like to kind of know what's going on behind the scenes, I think it's still very much an ongoing area of study, but more so simplified, when there is a presence of toxins, for example, we have enterochromatin cells that are part of our enteric nervous system and in like the lining of the gastrointestinal tract, and they can excrete neurotransmitters like serotonin, specifically 5-HT3. And this release serotonin ends up binding to receptors that are located on the vagus nerve that are closer to the end of the GI tract or the gastrointestinal tract. And this triggers a signal that's going to be transmitted all the way up to our brainstem, particularly areas like the area postrema, the nucleus tractus solitarius, so the NTS. And these regions are extremely important for our disgust-like responses, so things like nausea and vomiting. Actually, these areas together are called the vomiting centers. And another thing to note here is that the area postrema can also pick up any signals from the blood that might indicate that there is some type of pathogen trap, for example, like through a toxin. But at least at this point, you know, the signal can move back, so almost like in a loop to the GI tract. It can move to other regions of the body as well, other regions of the brain as well. So for example, in the body, it can move to muscle groups through those efferent signals, right? So maybe contracting the abdominal muscles, bringing in the diaphragm, the esophagus, that upper GI tract, and really leading to that nausea that we all have experienced, I'm sure, at some point. So there's a lot of points of crossover in this system. So I've really simplified that system. But even with the simplified version, there's so many points of contact here. And I mention all of that because here, you know, there's signals that are moving, there's signals that are converging, diverging, etc. And I think the individual differences that we really see are basically just subtle differences in those signals and the networks that disgust per se. And of course, disgust related responses like nausea and vomiting really move through, which can change the disgust response depending on individuals and even within individuals across time. But at the same time, as much as there are convergences in how we're seeing the neuroscience of it, we're seeing the physiology of it, there's also some divergences. So overall, for example, the function of pathogen disgust system is really to coordinate the avoidance of infectious disease. And we seem to see really an evaluation of a range of other inputs that might confer benefits to us. So really allowing for more so flexible responding. So for example, we maybe eat our favorite food that's maybe expired, but, you know, be disgusted by something that maybe we liked a lot less. So similarly, mothers are less disgusted by their own baby's feces compared to someone else's babies, which is really interesting. So there is flexibility in this system, and it's not that just because we face a pathogen, just because we see, for example, feces, we're immediately going to be disgusted. There is flexibility in the sense of, will we even feel disgust for, you know, A and B, even though it might be feces here and feces there. If it's your own child, for example, you might be less disgusted, which is, I think, really interesting as well. It's always important to mention the sex and age differences that we also see in these effects. And in disgust, generally, we see that disgust sensitivity actually decreases with age. And we also see that women tend to be more sensitive to disgust than men. And also similarly, in animal studies that we have with disgust, we see that females are typically more sensitive to disgust than males.
So I guess you've touched on this a bit, but is the disgust feeling we get, or the reaction we get to an object, like if you see rotten fruit and like, oh, that's disgusting, is that the same pathway and everything as disgust from an action, when if you think someone did something morally disgusting?
Yeah, so there definitely is some crossover. I actually really like the example of sexual disgust, because it in a way stems from pathogen disgust or disease avoidance, but pathogen or core disgust and sexual disgust also have their divergences. So sexual disgust may be based on more so the fitness of mating. So when I mention fitness of mating, or like a fitness of a mating partner, for example, I'm talking here from more so an evolutionary perspective. So maybe their ability to survive and reproduce, like their apparent health, their hygiene, etc. Interesting fact here as well. Attraction towards a potential partner can actually be hindered when it's paired with a pathogen threat across mammals, like humans, rats, mice, etc. So in essence, like, we can actually get the ick, especially from a novel partner. And that is one way of getting the ick. If
Can we make this a reel?
You can totally do what you want with that. Feel free, if you want me to say that again, I'm happy to, but I just thought that is hilarious and I just wanted to put that in, because I see all these TikToks that are like, oh, I got the ick from him. And I'm like,
that's,
I could probably tell you how you got that.
Is there any way then, and like, knowing that is one of the mechanisms behind it, you can intervene with that? Or is it just,
it's so hard, right? Because some, I guess, like, go eat at restaurants together that you know are going to have good food and make sure that your partner has good hygiene. It's just these really, you know, it's almost, it feels obvious, right? But it's just like, sometimes that doesn't happen. You know, life gets busy, or you try a new restaurant and it just completely sucks. And maybe you tried it with this partner and now you got food poisoning, and somehow you have paired that to your new partner, and now you've got the egg. I thought that was a fun example than just sexual disgust and how it stems from, to a degree, with passion disgust. So it's a nice example there, although, of course, we talk about some divergences there too. But as you mentioned, one of your examples was moral disgust, right? So that's another type of disgust. And I wouldn't say that it's as connected as sexual disgust and pathogen disgust. They've done some studies on how connected they are. I think moral disgust stems a little bit further. So just for some examples of what moral disgust would be. So we're thinking of, like, being disgusted at the sight of a robbery or cheating or disloyalty, or if we want, we could get political here too, right? All of these things can elicit moral disgust. And the prevailing theory with moral disgust is that it's more so about coordinating punishment or condemnation for most so socially undesirable behaviors. And here, what's really important is those facial expressions of disgust. And I think that's really interesting because I think anybody would say that moral disgust is more tied to social behaviors, but there really is a growing theory for this that's only gaining more and more support. But I think with all of this, we're only learning more. But I think one thing I want to end on here is that, you know, despite these unique functions that pathogen or core or sexual or moral disgust seem to serve, their underpinnings do have quite a lot of overlap. They do hinge on a lot of the same networks that we just discussed, but they do have their subtle differences. So one example is that moral disgust seems to rely a little bit more heavily on frontal regions of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex, the cingulate cortex, seem to be a little bit more important for moral disgust per se across individuals. So there are those subtle differences for sure that we do need to keep in mind, but there's quite a lot of overlap there too.
Awesome. It's so interesting. Now we're going to talk about some of your research specifically. Sure. So you used a rodent model of disgust, which I think is so interesting. Can you explain like how we can have a rodent model of disgust?
So during my PhD, I studied learning and memory. And I studied that in the context of disgust and disgust responses, particularly nausea. I particularly studied a type of nausea called anticipatory nausea. And I think the best example to really explain anticipatory nausea is chemotherapy-induced anticipatory nausea. And this starts out as an involuntary response directly to chemotherapy, because chemotherapy itself is very nauseating. However, once chemotherapy is repeatedly given within a hospital or a clinic where someone goes through their chemotherapy sessions, whether that be weekly, whether that be monthly or bi-monthly, you know, different cycles based on the type of chemotherapy, eventually they can come to pair that hospital or that clinic context with the chemotherapy. And I still remember to this day, very early on in my PhD, reading a few case reports, and one really stood out to me because it laid out the scene beautifully. And it spoke about a woman who looked back at the hospital she was going through chemotherapy in and immediately felt nauseated. And that just struck home with me. It was just intriguing that something that could save your life, your body is literally rejecting in this way, right? And I became more and more interested in this phenomena. And that's when I really started to think about anticipatory nausea and how we could really measure it in the lab. And what I did more specifically was develop this rodent model, specifically a rat model of anticipatory nausea. So one thing, of course, I have to say here is that a lot of the component parts of this model were made previously by Dr. Linda Parker. She is retired now, but she is an awesome scientist as well. And I would very much recommend looking at her work because she really laid the groundwork for this work here. And my PIs, Dr. Klaus-Peter Ozenkopf and Dr. Martin Cavaliers, also have done so much work in this area. So I'm really standing on the shoulders of giants here when I say that, of course, like in any form of science, right? We really work off each other. So I was able to, by the end of my PhD, edit this model and look at a few interesting factors, but they were really the people who created it at the end of the day. Yeah, so I think just to go back to the importance of it, like as much as nausea is a really important response to have, I mean, it can save us from literally infection and harm and, you know, the worst, dying. Sometimes it can be misplaced, right? And it can be unfortunately placed, which is something that has led to chemotherapy-induced anticipatory nausea for many people. And it's actually a huge reason for chemotherapy dropout for a number of individuals. And yeah, specifically 33 to about 40% of individuals who face anticipatory nausea end up dropping out of their chemotherapy because we just don't really have good treatments for it right now, which is super unfortunate. But that is really what my work started to build a model for, based on the models that did exist previously, as I mentioned.
So one of your papers researched how immune activation affects memory acquisition and consolidation of disgust. Can you explain what this study was and what you found?
Yeah. So just to explain kind of how I was studying this a little bit. So in rodents, and they can actually experience anticipatory nausea. As I mentioned, that was something that was established before I came into this. But really what was important for me is seeing if there's something of a treatment out there that we're not currently looking at. So how exactly I modeled it first. So in rats specifically, we can use a novel context, like a white box even, that they haven't been previously exposed to. So this is similar to how I mentioned that, you know, you can get the ick from a new partner. And individuals typically who go through chemotherapy sessions at a clinic, for example, are typically going to that clinic only for their chemotherapy and typically haven't visited it before. So it is about that novel or distinct environment that seems to matter a lot for anticipatory nausea. And once we have these rodents in this novel context or this distinct new context for them, we expose them to lithium chloride, which is in and of itself nauseating, like chemotherapy. The mechanisms are slightly different, but we do see this leading to behaviors which are indicative of nausea, which are gaping responses in rats. So gaping responses, it almost looks like they're chewing or about to vomit, but unlike humans, rats actually don't vomit. Another fun fact of the day. So it actually makes them a really nice model to study nausea itself, which is really what we're trying to look at, right, with anticipatory nausea. So it makes them a nice model for that. And similar to humans, after you expose these rodents to that novel context 3 to 4 times, we went with 4, they develop anticipatory nausea to where you no longer have to give the lithium chloride and they will display these gaping responses to simply being in that context. Is that not the coolest thing? So that, I mean, and I have to tell you, in science, I think there's many things where we measure behaviors and they are not consistent. Like you run a second group and the effect just disappears. But when I tell you this is like the most consistent effect I've ever seen, like across labs, across countries, I've run so many trials of this. It is so strong and so consistent. It makes for beautiful research, I will say. But again, my take here was understanding, okay, great, we're able to show these behaviors that are related to anticipatory nausea in rodents, but how do we block those? How do we prevent those from ever showing up, right? And so at this time, there was a bit of growing evidence in our lab already. With one paper that really got to me was this perspective on understanding how lipopolysaccharide, which is a gram-negative bacteria, it's an endotoxin, and primarily it's an immune activator. Really, the angle that I wanted to then take into this work was, great, we can show that rodents, specifically rats, can show anticipatory nausea, but how do we then block it or attenuate it? And there was some growing work, especially in our lab, that was looking at selective immune activation being able to attenuate this form of anticipatory nausea that we were seeing in rodents. Now, this was really interesting to me, but one of the issues I found with this work was that they gave exposure to lipopolysaccharide or LPS, which is a gram-negative bacteria. So it's a type of bacteria that is a lot more difficult to treat, typically derived from things like E. coli or Salmonella. And it has many functions, I will say, or mechanisms within the body, for example, but primarily it is an immune activator. So a lot of this previous work that initially I came into was exposing rodents to LPS or lipopolysaccharide 90 minutes prior to the establishment of anticipatory nausea in these rats. Now, I found that work really interesting because they were able to show this attenuation of anticipatory nausea. But at the end of the day, if we think about when patients are receiving treatment. Now, of course, coming to patients receiving treatments, you know, and I just talked about the polysaccharide, which is derived from E. coli, is a very, very long, right? It is, there's a lot of groundwork to do before that. But as I mentioned, I've always just looked a few steps ahead and thought about, okay, but like, how are we applying this work down the road? And to me, it wasn't clear how we would get there in terms of typically when we are providing some type of treatment, it's after something is already established. Now, if we're giving the polysaccharide before the establishment of anticipatory nausea to our rodents, like how meaningful really is that? So this 2023 paper delved into the question of, okay, if we were to expose these rodents to the polysaccharide after the event, right? So after they should have learned the anticipatory nausea, can it still attenuate that anticipatory nausea and reduce it? And so that was really what this paper was about. And I first started by just replicating that previous work that I was basing my assumptions off of, which is always a great thing to do in science. I should be doing that more to everyone out there. So the first experiment is really about that acquisition. And acquisition, I should define that first, is that initial creation of a memory. So when we give lipopolysaccharide prior to the establishment of anticipatory nausea, it's blocking that initial creation of a memory of anticipatory nausea. So that's really the focus there, which is all well and good. And honestly, super interesting that that can actually work. But again, I think to be a little bit more clinically focused and to think about the translatability at the end of the day, I wanted to look at consolidation. Now, consolidation is when there is a memory that exists, but we're strengthening it and trying to store it into our long-term memories. And that's when typically we start treatments, if not even further down the road. But that was a nice starting point to me, just looking after. And I was so proud of this paper because for the first time, I was able to show that yes, selective immune activation, whether you give it before, whether you give it after, it will attenuate anticipatory nausea based on the models that we've got. And so I think that that was something that was especially exciting to me. And I think just started a whole road of really intriguing experiments after that, because I could just see the advantage to us just learning more about, okay, cool. Low polysaccharide is doing this within this time point. How is it doing that, right? And that ended up becoming a little bit of what I explored in going forward. But I think we just need to delve deeper and deeper into what's going on there, because I do think that there is something there. And I think that can be so helpful.
You mentioned when we were just starting to talk about how anxiety and disgust, because I'm quite an anxious person and I get nauseous all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? A lot of the brain regions that we think of when it comes to anxiety actually do co-localize with a lot of the regions that we think of for disgust, which is really interesting. So I initially was never surprised that there was overlap, but there's like even more. So the reason that I mentioned that was because I wanted to eventually chat a little bit about, you know, is this something that we can treat, right? With chemotherapy-induced anticipatory nausea, is this something that's treatable right now? So currently, what's really the number one thing that's prescribed for this type of anticipatory nausea is ondansetron. So that's just a class of medications that are called serotonin 5-HT3 antagonists. And you've heard about that type of serotonin before, because that's really the one that is primarily involved when we're thinking about nausea. And that's all well and good. I mean, in terms of the mechanisms that are at the baseline involved, that is accurate, right? Goes back to our description of the mechanisms of nausea. But a lot of individuals, that 30 to 40%, are not responding to ondansetron. So what is going on here? And we're finding in rodent work, actually, that what does much, much better at reducing that anticipatory nausea is actually benzodiazepines. So anti-anxiety medication. Oh, so is this now developing from a nausea-like response to more so an anxiety-like response, right? So there is so much there to look at with humans, right? I think we can certainly, I'm just excited to see the future of this work here, because at the end of the day, I think the really big issue with bringing benzodiazepines, of course, to humans is that it is addictive, right? So we do have to be extremely careful there. But I think it just speaks to the perspective that we need to have in terms of shifting in order to really explore some of the ways that we can potentially treat anticipatory nausea. But I did want to share that, and why when you mentioned anxiety, I was like, there's something there. You are correct to assume that, because there's just so much complexity in how, when we think about disgust and when we think about disgust-related responses like nausea and vomiting, it doesn't just stay in its category. It hinges on to anxiety and a type of phobia, as you mentioned, right? And we see that overlap time and time again.
And it's so interesting, because anxiety also, like, one of the things is, if you're really anxious, you can't eat, and that's also similar if you have disgust. I've literally never thought about this connection before, but now I'm like, oh my god.
Brain blast.
So I found the link between anxiety and disgust that you kind of brought up really interesting. And I know, Beth, that you're an anxious girly. So I was just wondering about your personal take on feeling the link between disgust and anxiety, and if you've thought about it as disgust and anxiety, or if it's really just this idea of, like, being sick in both cases.
Yeah, so I obviously found that really interesting. And then I was thinking, do we just do these episodes and podcasts for more just self-knowledge?
This part is skip forward if you don't want to hear about us, guys.
If you don't want to know about us. Yeah, so I'm a very anxious person, and I also am a very nauseous person. I get nauseous all the time. I get carsick.
Like, besides anxiety? Oh, you do get carsick.
Well, I don't know. That's the thing. So when I was talking to Indra, I was like, wait, maybe it is all the same thing. So yeah, I get really carsick. I feel really nauseous. Definitely when I feel anxious, I cannot eat, like, at all. And it's kind of that similar feeling of, like, oh God, I feel nauseous and I just can't eat anything. So I thought that was really interesting to make that, because I hadn't really made that connection before. And then I also am really afraid of those holes. Do you know about this? Because yes. I was like, am I just a person who's, like, on the evolutionary scale all, like, anxious, nauseous, and afraid of holes? Like, I just am that type of person.
I know that exists, but I don't personally feel that
way. I find it, like, even thinking about it, I was thinking about recording this episode and thinking about, oh, what I talked to Ava about, and I thought about that, and it, like, makes me feel like I want to vomit.
So the little holes are like coral. Sorry to bring it up, but just for people to have a picture. I'm sorry that you also have to have a picture.
Oh, like, oh, it doesn't have to be coral. It can be, like, any sort of little, even sometimes if you make, like, pikelets, and there's, like, a little.
What? What's a pikelet?
Like, they're not pancakes. They're, like, another little, they're, like.
Oh, wait. Are you talking about when pancakes bubble and they have, like, the little bubbles?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't like that.
Any sort of, like, small net. Like, yeah, I think it's called tryptophobia,
something like that.
You can Google it, and it brings those images up, and it makes people sick. Even some, like, honeycomb, like, anything like that. And that's an evolutionary mechanism, is that something is off or poisonous, so we learn to, yeah. So some people have just maintained that fear, whereas other people have evolved out of it. I haven't. I'm holding on to it.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that was why. I thought it was, like, just an accident. I didn't realize that it was actually adaptive.
Yeah, because there's all these examples of it in nature where it does show that something is either rotten or off or poisonous. So I think there was, like, an example of, like, some frog or something. So that's why we had that fear.
Okay.
But I was wondering, like, are people who are more anxious, do they have more of this fear of holes? Like, am I just, like, all of that version of person? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, Indra mentioned the fact that people who are more easily disgusted in any domain are more easily disgusted in other domains. So it could be.
So also on that, I was thinking about, do you think that I can get more up in arms about moral things like between friends and other people?
I think you do get up in arms. I don't know if it's more than other people, but I feel like you feel a lot of feelings.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was thinking in terms of the disgust and the all this. I was like, oh, do I feel more moral disgust because I have all these other anxious tendencies? And I'd never connected that before.
But I don't feel that you have a disgust tendency. I feel that you have an anxiety tendency. I feel that those things are related in some ways, as Indra was talking about, but they seem very different in the sense that anxiety maybe is more linked to fear, which in the conceptualization of basic emotions, which as a non-neurobiology affect science person, a little bit of a controversial one. But, you know, I do think it makes sense, at least like in theory, that we would have evolved these specialized circuits and specific types of emotions for certain things like running away from danger versus like avoiding pathogens. And I think because both of those have that avoidance aspect that they seem linked in some ways. But I don't feel that you are disgusted really as your like default emotion, because I feel that disgust and like this idea of moral disgust, it's also more related in my eyes to like being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, a moral, okay, disgust. It's not necessarily like it's terrible that someone did that and therefore I want to do something about it. I want to defend my friend. It's just more like, ugh. It feels almost more like related to contempt than it would be to helping behavior, if that makes sense. Because it's more just like avoiding that situation and avoiding the person.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I guess I was just like combining everything into one.
I mean, it's true that disgust and anxiety can make you throw up, but it feels like in one situation, the throwing up from disgust feels like it's more basic, if we want to use that term again, yeah, in the sense that you throw up because you ingested something bad. So you're literally trying to get that out of your system. Whereas,
yeah,
throwing up from anxiety seems counterproductive, perhaps. Like if you're already anxious and then you throw up, no, that's probably not going to help. And I'm sure there's so much research on this, but I don't know the research on the links between anxiety and the gut and stuff like that. I know there's like a lot of new things about how your gut is so related to anxiety and all those nerves are so connected, but, and like the gut brain axis, but it does seem a bit weird. Like it just seems like it's more of a malfunction of the system than a feature of the system with anxiety.
Yeah, I guess it's trying to tell you something. Like, you know, we have anxiety to tell us something's wrong, and lots of people have that too much, and they're being told things are wrong all the time. If we think about an actual threat, and we do need to have that feeling of like, oh, this feels wrong, and that it's adaptive in that sense, I think. Like, I need to do something to change this.
Yeah, for sure. I think it definitely is adaptive in the sense of also avoidance, just maybe like avoiding something else, which I think was interesting when Indra was talking about the applications of her work to chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And what it sounded like to me from a lot of these studies, both with the rats, but also in the humans with people going through chemo, was that it's almost like classical conditioning where you're going into, yeah, something and this situation is being paired with something unpleasant, and then you learn to associate or expect that unpleasant thing happening from that stimulus that might not be unpleasant to begin with. But this idea of nausea specifically and disgust in chemo, I thought was interesting because it does feel that nausea, we first might link it to disgust unless we're an anxious girly like Beth, in which case we might automatically think anxiety. But it does feel like in that conditioning idea of like classical conditioning of pairing something with an unpleasant stimulus, that it does feel that maybe it's more of like an anxiety or fear response. Because let's say you're having chemo, it's, I don't know how many rounds you've gone through, and then you are going into the hospital looking at it, and you know that you're preparing yourself for this terrible thing that's going to happen that maybe isn't as disgusting as it is scary and anxiety provoking because it's going to be so uncomfortable. I think the quote that Indra read about that person like looking back at the hospital and automatically feeling, yeah, like they needed to throw up, that does feel like it's even more of a visceral response than just anxiety. But it feels like the interplay of those emotions seems really important and maybe is why like both of those emotions, anxiety and disgust, are like wrapped into this mm-hmm. behavior of vomiting. So it seems like maybe there's both and it's not just disgust operating, at least with that chemo example.
Yeah, I think that that makes sense. Have you had experiences like this, Ava? Or you're just like pretty steady, feeling fine?
No, I definitely feel like my tummy's turning sometimes when I'm anxious, for sure. Disgust? Yeah, I do think there are some times where there's these like very visceral reactions to someone committing some kind of morally wrong act. But I've also heard people saying that, for example, and like I don't speak Chinese well enough to know this, but that apparently in Chinese, you don't say that you're disgusted by something in terms of a moral disgust. And so people are less likely to feel that visceral response in that way. That's like, I feel sick to someone behaving in a like in a morally wrong way. But it feels like if there are different cultures in which we're not responding with this like disgust response to moral trespassing, then maybe that isn't so universal. And I don't feel like I necessarily have that response when there's like a moral wrong. But if someone is like, oh, that's disgusting what they did, I'm like, yeah, that was disgusting. And it makes it like an even worse condemnation. But I don't think I've ever been sick about a moral action. I feel like you've been sick, not from anxiety, but from being disgusted by someone's behavior or something that you've heard.
Yeah, maybe it's not so much disgust, but I feel like disappointment.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you're so, I just feel like disgust, because if we think about it in the evolutionary sense, it's like about getting rid of this pathogen. Like, I want it out of my sight. And I feel that you're very much not a get this person away from me. Like, I'm done with them. Like, in fact, the opposite. It's like you're all about rehabilitation. And you would be like, no, little pathogens. Like, come with me. It will be okay.
That's like when Indra was talking about the science behind the ick. I've like never felt that before.
Oh.
Like at all. And I was like, oh, maybe I need to be more. Well, I guess from the scientific explanation, it's like not positive.
But are you saying that you're not prone to the ick in general?
Yeah, not at all.
You never get the ick with the date? That's crazy. But maybe then, because this is an effect that presumably affects all humans because it's just pairing two stimuli together, that maybe you should try to get food poisoning on every date. And then whoever passes and you feel good with, maybe that's the person that you shouldn't be getting the ick with.
Yes, true. Like, so try and get the ick and whoever I like, okay, all right, that's
great.
Maybe I'll have more strict, like any criteria then.
Indra said she wanted her research to be applicable. 2 to 3 steps. Here we are.
Here we are.
Stepping outside of your research, so you mentioned you're a sustainability consultant or doing things for the environment. So how did you get involved in that? Does that fit with your science work? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always healthy in science to have hobbies and interests outside of science. I just think that's so important. So I'm so glad that yourself and Ava are doing these podcasts. And I think that comes from really being lucky enough to have a chance to spend a portion of my PhD not just focusing on my research, but a number of sustainability initiatives as well. So I chaired the sustainability committee at the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. And I really have to give it to the committee that I had at this time because they're so, you know, extremely passionate individuals. And it almost felt like a breeze to guide them to the first climate declaration that came out of Western University. And then that actually guided from the graduate level to an undergraduate level declaration. And now the university has declared a climate emergency. So it is really odd to have been leading the committee that brought about the first declaration at Western. So it was so nice to really be a trailblazer in that. And I think once I saw that I was able to do that, I think that ignited something in myself as well to like, yes, I can do more at Western. People here are listening. I think a lot of the times, as much as we want to do, sometimes the context is not the right one to do it. But at the end of the day, I think the path was there. And I think for me, I knew that it was a great time where people were listening and people want to do more. So at this point, I ended up moving to the President's Advisory Committee for Environment and Sustainability at Western then, where I had the chance to voice the graduate students' environmental concerns to the vice presidents, the provosts, and people who were literally making the action plans at Western, and hearing more about their plans and being able to give my feedback there too, which was an awesome table to be at. So really had a great time at Western in that community, just growing and learning so much. I mean, there are so many, I would say every single sector that we have has an aspect of environment and sustainability that we need to care about at this stage. And it was just really a great experience to have learned so much through that and also have actually contributed to that, which was really awesome. But now that I've started here at Mass General Hospital, I'm noticing that they don't have a postdoctoral level sustainability committee. So I've been thinking about seeing if I can create one. So that is what I'm hoping for in my next steps in this regard.
You would probably be interested in this. So, I mean, at the moment, I'm actually recording this from the Code Lab working space, but one of the things that they have is this community civic science hub kind of place. So it's like a lab that the community can come to. But how we get all the equipment is it's donated by, because all the other, like the universities and labs, because as you know, they just throw everything out. Like it's wild. Like we've got 100 microscopes, like all these PCR, like all this amazing stuff that was just going to be right now, and now we're using it. So like imagine if that all went to landfill.
Exactly. And I think that's exactly how we need to be thinking about science. I mean, we have to acknowledge it as scientists, there's a lot of waste when it comes to our projects, right? As there is in any sector, I think we can all be a lot more mindful of, you know, what the end point is for everything that we use, what the materials are down to their fibers, right? There's just so much, there's so much work to be done in this area. I think when I initially came into the sustainability committee at Western, the biggest event was more so like a cleanup of the university. And I think those are extremely necessary, but I think we also need to be doing more with our time at the end of the day. Like, as you mentioned, can we donate some of the stuff that we're using that we don't need anymore, especially if it's completely well and good, right? Then there's almost no reason. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's one of those things. I think sometimes I try to take a balanced view on it, where it's how much manpower is it going to take to understand what to do with something at every single step of the way? But then we also have to do a cost-benefit analysis of that, is like, where are we in terms of the health of the earth right now? And putting in an additional few hours to understand what to do at these time points, like, is that not going to be a greater benefit than the cost of those few hours? So that's how I've really looked at these things, where it's like, I want to take a balanced view, but at the end of the day, if anything, it's more balanced to care about the planet at this point, right? And if anything, what are we going to do? Make the earth better? Like, that's right. That's the worst. Like, so it just only makes sense.
So my PhD is on the optimism bias. And
I love that.
In like computational psychiatry, like looking to see if we can increase optimism for people with depression, anxiety. And one of the examples I always use is like with global warming, is kind of like what you just mentioned. So you could just be like, you know, there's no hope or whatever, and you don't do anything, but then we won't have any chance. Like the only way, it's like exactly what you said, what's the worst that can happen if we try? Things get better. So I'm with you on that one. Well, this has been amazing. And if you would just like to finish with what you're excited about that's coming up next.
Yeah, I would love to. So, of course, right now in early June, I started my postdoctoral work. So I think something that I'm really excited about is coming from more so a behavioral neuroscience background, learning so many molecular techniques now that are just been super fascinating. And the lab that I'm working with now is also awesome. So it's really nice to be in a great environment. I'm really looking forward to learning so much more because I'm so excited to really learn all of these techniques and approaches and bring them back to affective neuroscience, because at the end of the day, that in that area is certainly my baby. And I think learning more and applying it to a lot of different fields and a lot of different clinical applications as well, which I'm doing now, is only going to teach me more about how to bring it back to a lot of these fundamental emotions, which I really cannot wait to get back to. So yeah, I'm so excited to just learn a lot more in the next few years and come back to this field. And hopefully maybe we'll see a treatment. Maybe we'll see a better treatment one day. And I hope to have my hands in that somehow, in some way.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. This has just been awesome.
Thank you. Awesome.
Thank you to Dr. Indra Vishnoi for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Montesouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.